This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Lin Mark and Wong Shaoning. It's 7:36 a.m., Tuesday, the 5th of May. How are we doing this morning, Shaoning? It's a nice sunny day.
Yeah, and you know, this morning I saw my first batch of joggers out there already.
Really?
Yes. I think some people are beginning to get back to their exercise routine. It was like, what, 47 days, 48 days?
I'm surprised you haven't joined them yet, actually, considering how dedicated you were to running before the MCO.
Well, considering our hours, that would mean I would actually have to be out there at about 5 in the morning. And even though I would say I'm quite a plucky kind of a woman, there are limits to my bravery because it would be relatively very dark. And since I don't live in the gated, guarded, a little scary too. I think I draw the line at about 6:15, 6:30 when the sun starts to kind of peak out. Then I feel, yeah, then I'm out. But any earlier than that, yeah, it gets into the dangerous, creepy territory. Because yeah. You never know, right? So not a good idea. But I'm dying to have my first run on Saturday morning.
Yes, and I know that because since yesterday was the start of the CMCO, I know that some golfers made their way onto the golf courses already, very first day, with it, everything else is open again. Just be sure to maintain your social distancing, I guess, is all I have to say, really.
It's true. I mean, if anything, it really teaches us to appreciate what's out, you know, the outdoors, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I learned some new skills. I'm very good at jumping jacks because I was forced to do it in the house. So yeah, whether we learn how to bake bread, sew stuff, or like I say, do push-ups and jumping jacks, that's my new thing.
All right. And of course, we are still running on slightly different timing this week. But the breakfast grill is on at 8 o'clock as per usual. So later on after the 8 a.m. news bulletin, Shaoning's going to be speaking with Thorsten Beck, Professor of Banking and Finance at Cass Business School.
Yeah, because in 2008, the financial crisis was caused by something very different, right? It was caused by reckless and over-leveraged banks. But of course, today is very different. So world economies are being brought to their knees by this COVID-19 pandemic. But the question is, will this have a knock-on effect on the global financial system? And this is significant, right? Because then it has further repercussions throughout the rest of different industries. So Thorsten Beck, who's a professor of banking and finance at Cass Business School in London, is going to join me to discuss this issue. And interestingly, we're going to have a little bit of a discussion on Bank Negara because he was a visiting scholar here too.
Oh, very interesting. Okay, and if you want to tune into that conversation, be sure to stay tuned here after the 8 o'clock news. Otherwise, you'll be able to find it on podcast on the BFM app as well as on Spotify later today. But right now, we're taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers. I have the New Straits Times in front of me. Headline here is Follow CMCO and SOPs or Face Action. Because this is something that the government has actually come out to say, you know, that states who don't follow the federal ruling may actually face court action, and businesses as well who don't follow SOPs may face action.
Yeah, so does this mean that states can enforce stricter SOPs, or they must just, you know, that's why I'm a bit confused.
Yeah, so there is an article. There is an article on page 4 of the NST that tries to go into this a little bit, talking about how all states are subject to the CMCO because it has now been gazetted. So this MCO Phase 5 has been gazetted with a start and an end date, which means that any regulations under the MCO Phase 4 are no longer in effect. So, for example, MCO Phase 4, you were allowed 2 people in a car.
Now
MCO Phase 5 is 4. So if states continue to enforce the 2 people in a car rule, apparently they will then be in the wrong.
Oh, really? Okay, because I was confused because the day before yesterday, Defence Minister said that each state can take their time, right, to implement even stricter MCOs. Because I believe, like, for example, Selangor has come out to say specifically you have to wear masks in public. Whereas I think in FT, that's not enforced, it's encouraged. But I don't know, I could be wrong, you know,
there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, there's a bit of confusion going on. Meanwhile, in the Star, the front page is all foreign workers must be tested. Mm-hmm. And apparently you, as the employer, have to pay for it. So, you know, there's a bit of uproar, especially if you're, let's say, a manufacturing company or even a plantation company where you're very dependent on foreign workers. This is going to be a bit of a heavy burden for you. I think that there are questions about that. And then there's a picture of this gentleman enjoying his what looks like a kopi o in a Chinese coffee shop on Jalan Sultan, but keeping his social distance while having a face mask on. So I guess we are looking at pictures of what is the new normal.
Yes, and actually on the NST page 5, there is a picture of our transport minister, Dato' Sri Dr. Wee Ka Siang, also appearing to employ the same social distancing tactics while taking the train. Because he's saying he's urging commuters to follow SOPs while they're taking public transport. But the picture that accompanies this article, I kind of look at it and I'm like, I don't really think that's 6 feet between the minister and the other commuters. But then, you know, it's a bit tough, I guess, on public transport because space is so limited.
Yeah, I'm also very curious. I'm sure some of you all received this pictures on social media, right?
Yes.
What looked like a very crowded MRT station with some people with masks and some people with not. I really don't know. Were these pictures taken yesterday or were these pictures taken a long time ago? Because there were other pictures by Rapid KL which showed not many people taking public transport, and they also reported that it was, you know, it wasn't definitely not 100% capacity.
See, that's the thing. I was thinking about this yesterday as well when a number of people forwarded me these images, not just of MRT stations, of queues outside, you know, purported KL malls. And I'm very skeptical of these pictures because I don't know who's sending them to me. These pictures don't have a timestamp. Mm. Okay? You don't know whether they were taken prior to the MCO. You don't know whether they were taken today. You don't know where they are in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Because if the picture is just of a random storefront, it could be anywhere. It doesn't necessarily say, oh, this is Central KL. You know,
there was no guy holding up a newspaper while taking that picture, which is
exactly.
Like,
and you're not taking a picture with like a convenient street sign.
Yeah.
In the photo, right?
I mean, some of the malls, actually, one of the malls actually came out to say why there was a queue going around the building. And it's actually because they were taking the temperature of every single staff that was actually going in. And it took about an hour to clear everybody. So, you know, it wasn't crowds of people rushing into the mall to do shopping. And I think a lot, like Malaysia Kini sent out reporters, and you can see it on their website, to go and look at what the crowds at Mid Valley, KLCC. Guess what? There were no crowds. And then they went to interview a few shops that had opened, whether people were apprehensive. And yes, there was some apprehension, but some businesses were kind of glad to get started. So it's similar headline in the Malay Mail. So they went to interview the famed KL eateries, because, you know, we are all about our food, right?
And a Malaysian without food?
Yeah, what is a Malaysian without food? So, you know, they asked, like, are you ready for dining? And apparently most restaurants aren't, because they're not ready in the sense that there's a lot of SOPs. You have to sign in. You got to get the guests. You take their temperature, write their name, their IC, their address, 1 meter. So some restaurants are like, for the moment, please just take it away. That's the new normal again.
Yeah. So this is still, you know, a bit of an adjustment period, I think, to the CMCO, because it was implemented very fast. It was given, we had 3 days notice over a public holiday weekend. So I think a lot of people are still adjusting to this new environment. That said, I saw quite a lot of cars on the road
yes.
this morning. So if you are going to work, please stay safe and be sure to employ social distancing, sanitize when you can, wear a mask. And we're going to be bringing you more business news in just a second. Right now, we have some messages. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Shaoning. 7:46 a.m., Tuesday, the 5th of May. We're into day 2 of this CMCO. And today we have some business news for you, specifically that one of the largest fund management companies in Malaysia, Permodalan Nasional Berhad, say they expect to maintain competitive returns across its funds this year, despite the turbulent conditions that the world is facing. During its virtual press conference on its 2019 annual report, PNB noted that its gross incomes in 2019 contracted around 26% to 15.1 billion ringgit compared to a year earlier, while net incomes fell about 37% on year to 10.7 billion ringgit.
Now, PNB reportedly disbursed 13.2 billion ringgit in income distribution and bonuses to its unit holders in the year under review, which was 12% lower than the $15 billion it paid out in 2018. PNB Group Chairman Tan Sri Dr. Zeti Aziz said that the challenges have arisen given the weak market. I think this is a rather obvious thing. And if you ask me, 2020 is going to be an even bigger challenge for them. So, you know, the fund's ability to perform will depend on several factors. The absence of another wave of virus, the implementation of announced policies, addressing the issues related to SMEs and rising unemployment, and how quickly consumer spending will pick up. Now, PNB President and Group Chief Executive Jalil Rashid added that the environment is rapidly changing, and he said that there will be weaker numbers ahead as the fund is mindful that it is recording weaker earnings this year given these conditions. So now, the takeaway about this is that, if you ask me, they're telling you, if you're a unit holder, 2020, whatever returns you expect is going to probably be lower than what you got in 2019. I think that's pretty much a foregone conclusion when you look at the KLCI alone, right? On a year-to-date basis, it's down 13% already.
And we're only 5 months into the year. But according to Jalil as well, despite these challenging conditions, PNB is still looking to diversify its asset base across a range of asset classes in order to avoid any kind of concentration risk. Since, he says, the current weak global market has opened up some opportunities for acquisitions of quality stocks at cheap valuations. So Jalil says global conditions have not deterred the fund from investing overseas, as PNB will continue to diversify across geographies as well, although it is going to have to keep an eye on the strength of the ringgit, which today is at 430, 165 against the US dollar.
Not that strong, I would have to say, the ringgit. But if you look at PNB versus EPF, okay, their global exposure stood at 8.5% versus 3.3% in the preceding year. At the top of my head, I think EPF overseas exposure is much higher at about 20%, which kind of helped them generate the kind of returns for 2019. The firm, of course, PNB, is also targeting to increase this to 30% by 2022. I think it's a similar target to that of EPF. So of its global investments, 70% were public equity investments as at end 2019, with 14% in real estate and 4% private investments and 12% cash. Now, of course, the downside to global investments is that some years are good, some years are not so good. But anyway, if you look at the US stock market, you know, if you had lots of money in NASDAQ on a relative basis, you wouldn't be so bad off, because it's actually amazingly only down about 3% on a year-to-date basis. Dow Jones is down 17%, while S&P 500 is down 12%. So yeah, even the foreign US markets are doing better than, I would say, Asian markets. For example, if you look at Australia, that's down 20%. And of course, Europe is really feeling the brunt. The CAC 40, which is the French market, is down, for example, 26%. So yes, diversification is probably one way to kind of manage the volatility. But of course, that exposes you to currency risk. But maybe because the ringgit continues to weaken, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You would have some translation gains.
And if we take a look at Singapore, Singapore's also down about 20%. Am I reading that right? On a year-to-date basis? Yeah, so Singapore is also an interesting subject because they so far have had the dubious honour of having the highest number of COVID-19 cases in the Southeast Asian region. And according to a key government minister, Singapore's battle with the COVID-19 pandemic has not yet reached its halfway point, even as the country is now considering how they're going to be lifting partial lockdown measures. So while the city-state has and will continue to allow some gradual easing of its partial lockdown measures, some key restrictions will remain in place until June 1st. And this is according to the Minister for National Development, Lawrence Wong. So Singapore's health minister also said that the country will only consider lifting its circuit breaker measures when the government is assured that community transmission locally is either stemmed or very low. In an ideal situation, they should fall to zero or single digits daily with very low numbers of unlinked cases, according to him, not just for the day, but sustained over a period of time.
Yes, he also added that the government will also need to make an assessment of the situation globally on reopening Singapore's borders because, let's face it, Singapore is all about trade, right? It's all about business. It's Southeast Asia's financial centre. So, you know, it's going to be hard for them to come back if, let's say, they're not going to allow any foreign visitors or any tourists, right, to come and do business there. But for any border reopening, the island nation will, of course, I think what they'll do is they'll start small and selectively and continue to impose a mix of isolation and testing requirements. So as businesses in Singapore begin to reopen, the government will need to also step up its testing capability and capacity as well. So I think this is something all nations are considering. I read this article that if you fly into Austria now, you can do a test on the spot. You have to pay for it, but immediately they'll give you a test.
Interesting. How much? Yeah. Do we know how much they have to pay?
I can't remember, but it won't be cheap. Nothing's cheap anymore. But that's one way of kind of managing whether this, you know, I don't know, because it depends what kind of test you have also. And, you know, as we know, some people test negative and then subsequently turn out to be COVID-19 patients later, so who knows? But I guess what is happening is governments mm-hmm. are kind of finding their ways and coming out with their own individual respective SOPs as to how to open up their economies.
Yeah, and when it comes to Singapore, of course, the interesting SOP that everybody will be keeping an eye out for is how they're going to deal with their migrant worker issue. Because while Singapore moves to reopen its economy, thanks in part to fewer infections in the wider community, the number of COVID-19 cases in India migrant worker dormitories has continued to surge. So Singapore reported another 573 infections on Monday, bringing the country's total to more than 18,000. And of that cumulative figure, the majority are linked to dormitories where more than 300,000 people live. So in an effort to deal with this, the government does have plans to further expand its healthcare facilities and more than double its daily testing capacity. And that's been in place since early April. But Singapore already has the capacity to conduct about more than 8,000 tests a day. So they're looking to increase that testing capacity by fivefold to 40,000 a day by later this year.
Yeah, despite its best efforts, the situation at the workers' dormitory, of course, is a far cry from the early months of the pandemic, when I think Singapore was seen as the, you know, the global role model in terms of how to control the virus response. Because before the start of April, the country's total number of confirmed infections was only 1,000. So it was almost as if the migrant workers was this blind spot, you mm-hmm. know. And because they lived in rather cramped conditions, this virus was allowed to spread, and you know, testing wasn't necessarily done on them. But now I gather that they're actually putting up some of these migrant workers in unused ships, you know, those cruise liners that aren't going anywhere. Because, you know, Singapore's a small island, right? Where are you going to house these 300,000 people? You need to spread them out. You can't put them all in one place,
no,
right?
No, you can't have 14 people sharing an apartment when you're worried about COVID-19 transmission.
Yeah, the other thing interesting about Singapore is that they are planning to start schools again on May 12th in small groups. You know, that's quite brave. I think there's a lot of apprehension, especially in Malaysia, about starting schools. But if you look at the example in Europe, what's unusual is that universities are going to start later, but actually it's the nurseries and kindergartens that are starting earlier. And the argument or the justification for that is that a lot of parents are going to start going back to work. And what are they going to do with these young kids? It's going to be very difficult to manage this. So the state in Europe is considering that. But I guess the issue is always you just really, really have to monitor the infection rates, you know, constantly. Mm-hmm. And even for us, Malaysia, whether this CMCO works, we'll really only know whether we as Malaysians are disciplined and maintaining our SOPs, our personal hygiene, keeping our social distancing, whether that's effective. Not today, but in 2 weeks' time when we see the numbers. And hopefully the curve continues to be flat or flattened even more.
Absolutely. And I guess here in Malaysia, we have also seen announcements that our childcare centres are going to be allowed to open for that same reason. You know, as the economy starts to reopen, parents need to go back to schools. And yes, if you have schooling age children, it's a little bit easier, you know, age 7 and above. But if your kids are under the age of 7, someone needs to be with them. And if that someone is, if there's no other option but a parent, then that parent can't go to work. And I guess the fear is also if universities open, university students in crowded conditions. A lot of university students, particularly here in Asian countries, also still live with their parents. And if they go back, you know, they're more likely to transmit COVID-19 to elderly parents. So there's no easy answer to this. And there's really no answer that will say, okay, you'll have no infections whatsoever. So governments are in the unenviable position of having to say, okay, you know, how can we reopen the economy in a way that results in the fewest, least fatal cases possible?
Yeah, I think it's always going to be a challenge, right? I think there's no one way of doing it. I mean, but one island which has kind of, you know, has succeeded, hasn't had much local infection, I do believe that's Hong Kong. They haven't had any new cases in, I think, about 10 days. But on the flip side, you look at the economy, it's paid a price, right, in terms of the social distancing.
Because they probably haven't had cases because nobody was flying to Hong Kong anyway because of the protests. So they didn't import anyone.
No, but it's a very small place, right? So social distancing is a challenge in Hong Kong. But they enforced it. They locked down their borders. They were very strict. But as a result, their economy did contract 8.9% in the first quarter from a year ago levels now, according to the government. And this is the worst quarter on record, right? This decline even surpasses the previous record of a 8.3% contraction in the third quarter of 1998. And this is also the third straight quarterly contraction for Hong Kong, the longest stretch since, I think, the global financial crisis of 2009. Not helped by the fact that they had a wave of protests even before COVID-19. So, their financial secretary, Paul Chan, said that Hong Kong's economic situation is very challenging and it is deep into recession. So it's not a shallow recession. They don't even call it a technical recession. It's a deep recession. So Hong Kong's export, international travel, business investments, all going to be impacted by pandemic. And, you know, with it still not under control and because they're an open economy, I think they'll feel the brunt of this even in the future quarters ahead.
Yeah, already I think they're heading into what could potentially be the worst full-year performance on record with a contraction of as much as 7% expected in the wake of all of these disruptions. But right now we are heading into the 8 o'clock news bulletin. And then after that, here we're going to be having the Breakfast Grill where Wong Xiaoning speaks with Thorsten Beck, Professor of Banking and Finance at Cass Business School, on what's been happening in the global economy today. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.